WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The National Rifle Association held its annual convention earlier this week. On the first part of our show, we heard from Tanya Metaxa, the head of the NRA's lobbying group. My guest, Osha Gray Davidson, is the author of Under Fire, The NRA and the Battle for Gun Control. His book chronicles the history of the NRA, its goals, its lobbying techniques, and its internal power struggles. I asked him the same opening question I asked Metaxa. What do you think was the most important outcome of the convention?
I think actually the most important outcome so far is the fact that the NRA really didn't make a change in direction based on the public outcry in the wake of George Bush's resignation and the letter that Wayne LaPierre had sent out. There was a moderate wing within the NRA that wanted to take the organization back from a very hardcore Second Amendment fundamentalist group. They saw this as their opportunity to do that, but they didn't really make any inroads at the convention. So actually, I think what didn't happen is more important than what did happen.
When you use the expression Second Amendment fundamentalist, what do you mean?
Yeah, I have a very specific meaning for that. These are people who believe that the defining characteristic of being an American is the right to own a gun. Now, for them, that's the most important attribute of being an American. And it's hard for a lot of other people to understand. Tanya Metaxa has said that the fight over the Second Amendment is not about guns, it's about freedom. And these people really believe that guns aren't really the most important part of the issue. It's freedom, but only the freedom to carry guns. And it's kind of an arcane philosophy that is somewhat widespread in this culture, not just within the NRA. And these people have managed to take over a group that used to be devoted to hunting and the shooting sports and turn it into a Second Amendment fundamentalist group that really is devoted only to upholding the Second Amendment. When I interviewed the then head of their lobbying wing for my book a couple of years ago, I asked him, how important is the Second Amendment? He called it the queen of the Bill of Rights, the most important amendment. I think most Americans don't believe that. They believe that other things are far more important in the Bill of Rights. But for these people, it all comes down to the right to own a gun. And I think it's a strongly held belief in violence as the way that we solve problems that these people have.
But in all fairness, the NRA isn't preaching violence. It's preaching self-protection and hunting and just the right to bear arms as is guaranteed in the Constitution. They're not...
Right. And that's why I said that not that they're pro-violence, but that they believe strongly in the efficacy of violence before they believe in the efficacy of other means of dealing with an oppressive government, for example.
So you think that the current split within the NRA is between those people who think the emphasis should be on hunting and sports activities and those who believe that the right to own a gun is the most fundamental right within the Constitution?
Yes, but that battle has been brewing for quite some time. And Tanya Metaxa was right when at the NRA convention she said that there is no battle for the soul of the NRA. But she's right only in that battle has been won. The battle for the soul was won by the Second Amendment fundamentalists.
When was it won?
Well, they've just recently consolidated that victory. But I'd say in the early 1990s was when those adherents, the true believers, like Neil Knox, who's a board member and who brought Tanya Metaxa into the organization back in the 1970s, when he got back on the board, that really signaled the defeat of the hunters and sports shooters. There had been a fight back and forth for several years. Neil Knox himself had been booted off the board of the NRA because he was too extreme. He managed to get back onto the board and over a period of a couple of years purged the organization of those people who were against him and who were more in line with the old view of the NRA than with this new, what I call Second Amendment fundamentalism.
How did the NRA become a very strong lobbying group?
I think you can really point to a turning point for that NRA's metamorphosis into the gun lobby. It's called in NRA lore the Cincinnati Revolt in 1977. the NRA had been drifting, according to a few hardcore members, moving into other areas like hiking, outdoor activities. And in fact, they were considering closing their Washington office and moving out to Colorado and putting less emphasis on lobbying instead of more. Well, that was anathema to a man named Harlan Carter, who was a very powerful man within the NRA. He, in 1977, at the Cincinnati members meeting, with a group of similarly minded, hardcore Second Amendment fundamentalists, took over the NRA, kicked out the old guard of hunters and target shooters, and really created the gun lobby. Harlan Carter was dedicated to the proposition that the NRA should be devoted almost exclusively to gun owners' rights. And that's really the path that they've walked down ever since then. Harlan Carter is an interesting person, though. He really exemplifies the problem with guns in this country. When the NRA says, look, it's just good guys against bad guys, it's the criminals that we shouldn't have as gun owners, and they're the real threat, that hides the fact that Harlan Carter, in 1931, when he was a 17-year-old, got into a fight with another boy who was 15 and shot this boy to death. Carter was convicted of murder, but that conviction was overturned on appeal because the judge didn't give adequate instructions to the jury, and he was let free. He changed the spelling of his name to hide the fact that he had shot somebody in an argument.
In your research into the NRA for your history of the organization, did you find any connections between the NRA and the militia movement?
There's two ways of looking at that, I think. The first is a similarity of rhetoric. Tanya Metaxa and others within the NRA like to say that their language doesn't do anything to bolster the views of extremists, and that this one letter certainly what shouldn't be looked at as a cause of a bombing. But if you look at the NRA rhetoric over years, a pattern does become apparent. Let me read just a couple of quotes from NRA mailings over the last 2 years. Our government creeps toward authoritarian rule. Wake up, America. Little by little, your freedom and safety are being robbed. Another one says, the time has come for the showdown of the century. Will you fight or will you fold? Another says, good people could have their doors kicked in and their property taken away by a police state driven by masters of deceit. That kind of language is virtually identical to the language of these militias. And what it does is it tells these people who are on the extreme fringes of society that their paranoid delusions about an authoritative government or authoritarian government taking over your lives, that's a legitimate fear. And the way that you fight that is through guns. So I think at that level, the NRA does bear a certain amount of responsibility for validating these paranoid delusions. In another sense, there's another link between the NRA and these groups in that some of their board members do have some connections. The prime one is Robert Brown, who's a member of the NRA board and is the publisher of Soldier of Fortune magazine, which is a sort of house organ for paramilitary types in this country. The NRA can try to distance itself from these people as much as it wants, but there are definite links. And the fact that these people seem to think that the NRA, the people in the militias, think that the NRA backs up their positions, the NRA should be asking themselves, if the NRA doesn't represent their positions, why is there this misunderstanding from those people? Timothy McVeigh, in 1992, sent a letter to a congressman in New York decrying gun control, and on the back he had a sticker that said, I'm the NRA.
Osha Gray Davidson is my guest. He's the author of the book Under Fire, The NRA and the Battle for Gun Control. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Osha Gray Davidson, the author of a book about the NRA called Under Fire. How has the NRA's rhetoric in its mailings to members and its recruiting mail changed in the past few years?
Well, it's just gotten more extreme. As I pointed out, they've been using a lot of this rhetoric for quite a while. I think the frequency of it has certainly increased. The NRA has a purpose in doing this. What they're trying to do is deflect media attention from the issue of gun control to the issue of the ATF and rogue elements within law enforcement. That's one of their main reasons for doing it. When I hear reporters ask the NRA about these connections and about the charges against ATF, it makes me think that a lot of journalists are playing into the NRA's hands by continually asking about tenuous connections, letting the NRA reiterate its case, instead of asking them, what about the fact that 40,000 Americans lose their lives to gun violence every year? What about the fact that we have some 1,500 children being shot accidentally every year in this country? Why aren't you in particular willing to institute some programs to do something about that?
Well, the NRA says it supports guns for law-abiding citizens, not guns for criminals. And in fact, it supports very harsh measures for criminals.
The NRA has a very simplistic view of gun violence in this country that they've been able to put across with some convincing rhetoric. They divide society into good guys and bad guys as if that's the way the real world works instead of a crime show on TV. According to FBI statistics, only 1 in 5 murders in this country occurs during the commission of another felony, rape, robbery, a break-in. Most murders, the overwhelming majority of murders in this country, are committed during the course of arguments or mistakes, accidental shootings. Those are the kinds of things that we need to pay attention to. And admittedly, gun control is not always and certainly not the only thing to do about crime control. The problem is gun control or crime is not the main problem when it comes to gun death in this country. It's other factors. So I think what needs to be done is realizing that this is a complex problem. Gun control is not going to take care of all of it, but certainly common sense says that when you've got 40,000 people being killed every year by guns in this country, then you have to do something about those guns. And there are many things that you could do besides just banning the putative right to own guns.
You say in your book that a lot of Americans don't really understand the guns that are being debated in gun control debates, and that a lot of the press makes the mistake of not really understanding the difference between automatic and semi-automatic weapons, which is an important distinction within the debate. So let me ask you to explain for us what an assault weapon is, what's the difference between an automatic and a semi-automatic weapon.
Okay. What's generally called an assault weapon is not a true assault weapon. Assault weapons were invented basically in World War II to fire in two separate means at a flip of a lever. On one setting, it would fire one round for each pull of the bullet. On the automatic setting, they would fire a constant stream of bullets as long as you had your finger on the pulled down on the trigger, the trigger depressed. That's a select fire gun, also called an assault weapon. Those were heavily regulated in this country in the 30s, almost banned, you could say. What we call now assault weapons are the semi-automatic versions of those weapons. They look like the original weapons that can fire on automatic, but they cannot fire on automatic because that's illegal. They fire on semi-automatic, which is one bullet for every individual pull of the trigger. I, in fact, wrote a piece for the New York Times against the assault weapons ban in August of last year because I agree with the NRA on this one point in that it doesn't help to ban a whole series of guns that are functionally identical to another group of guns that aren't being banned. And I think in a way it plays into the NRA's arguments because it says there are some guns that are dangerous and some guns that aren't. My point and the point of lots of other gun owners and who do favor mild gun control is that all weapons are killing machines, not just so-called assault weapons. And what we have to do is have our laws take that into account. And instead of breaking guns down into one class or another for laws, let's treat them all for what they are. They're killing machines. If we're going to have rights to own them, then let's have responsibilities to own them in a way that doesn't cause destruction. And there are ways that you can do that. And unfortunately, the NRA has not allowed Congress to pass much meaningful gun control. There have been some. I think the Brady Bill is an example of a good gun bill. And one part of the assault weapons ban is good. The fact that you can't have guns with large magazines that can hold virtually endless streams of bullets, I think that's clearly a good thing.
When you went back and researched the history of the NRA, did you learn things about the NRA's past that made you see the group in a completely different light?
I did, but in part that's because I didn't have a very clear view of what the NRA had become over the years. I was a member of the NRA when I was young. I was a sport shooter, target shooter. And at that time, I thought that the NRA was merely a sporting organization. And I think for a lot of Americans, that's what it was. I was surprised to find out how far it had gotten from its original mission of sport shooting, and how the way I like to see it is the NRA went from being a sports organization that did some lobbying to a lobby that has done less and less in terms of sport shooting. And I think they've gotten so far into the extreme on the gun lobby side that they've alienated what used to be the backbone of the organization, the sport shooter. And that was, yes, a surprise to me.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Osha Gray Davidson is the author of Under Fire, the NRA, and the Battle for Gun Control. He spoke to us from Iowa City. This is Fresh Air.